The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Haviv Rediger is one of the chief correspondents for the Times of Israel. I listen to Haviv whenever he's on Dan Senor's podcast, Call Me Back. I also am now listening, Haviv, to your standalone pods over at Times of Israel. I listen to the daily podcast at Times of Israel. I try and keep up with Israel's War of Survival in Gaza with all of those podcasts. I listen to Daniel Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi. Michael Oren's on a lot. But I think Americans have got a fundamental misunderstanding about what's going on. Fundamental. And you said it on Sunday. This war is not going to end until Hamas is destroyed, dismantled. Why is that? And when is that in sight?
I think it's very simple. Hamas made it simple. Hamas is one of these kinds of enemies that make things very simple. They want to destroy Israel. They want to destroy Israel for very big, very dramatic reasons. They have a vision of Islamic renewal and redemption. They're a particularly radical form of Islam. They are willing to destroy Gaza to achieve that end. In other words, Hamas has ruled Gaza for 17 years. And in those 17 years, this is a Google challenge for our listeners, it has built nothing in Gaza except the tunnels. And it built those tunnels for no reason other than to start this war and then force Israel. The only way to get them out of Gaza once this kind of war is started is to go through the civilian population. That's the whole story of Hamas. Hamas, and by the way, Hezbollah. What is Hezbollah's great strategy in Lebanon? Hezbollah has already basically made Lebanon a failed state. Listeners should Google the Houthi war in Yemen. 85,000 children have starved to death in that war. The Iranian proxies, everywhere they are demolishing their own societies. And Iran itself has probably spent a double-digit percentage of its economy just on this dream of destroying Israel. And so at some point, you look at the enemy and you say, I believe you. I take you seriously. This doesn't stop until Hamas in Gaza, the regime of Hamas in Gaza, is destroyed. If it isn't, then we're going to be back here in this war in Gaza with Gazans suffering terribly, with Israelis facing whatever new crazy scheme and horrific atrocity Hamas manages to cook up in 10 years.
What I heard you say to Dan with great clarity is that 90% of Israel agrees with the proposition that Hamas must be destroyed and that Israel is not turning back. There isn't any division in the country that reflects the division in the United States that we see with Kamala Harris's incoherence and Joe Biden's occasional rambling, but the demonstrations in the street. That doesn't exist in Israel. We do see demonstrations on behalf of the hostage families, and our heart goes out to them. But the odds of getting back all those hostages are now objectively very low. And the only way to do it is with war and going into Rafah. But Ramadan looms. I wanted to ask you, do you give a lick? Do Israeli give a lick that Ramadan is coming up, given that the fundamentalist Hamas group has attacked on one of your holy days? And before that, the Yom Kippur War 50 years ago was launched on one of your holy days. Does Israel actually going to hold back through all of Ramadan not to go into Rafah?
I think you said it exactly right. You know, the Arab world, the Arab countries, in their own choice of scheduling wars when it was their war to start, for example, the 73 war, they didn't just start the war on Ramadan. They called it the glorious Ramadan war. And so the idea that you can't fight wars on Ramadan is, it's a new invention special for Israel. That's not serious. There is a real concern in Ramadan, and the concern is that throughout the Muslim world, people generally are resting during the day over the course of Ramadan because they fast during the daylight hours. And it's a time of tremendous amount of, for example, peak television watching. So there are special series produced all year to watch on Ramadan. And so everyone is tuned in to Al Jazeera, and any conflict between Israelis and Palestinians becomes headline news everywhere in the Muslim world over Ramadan. So there's a kind of heightened tension over Ramadan. I have to tell you, that doesn't mean our hostages sit another month. It doesn't mean Hamas survives an extra month unnecessarily. Why should we genuinely worry about Ramadan when they frankly used a Sabbath holiday overlap on Simchat Torah on October 7th to attack us when they themselves would gladly attack us on Ramadan? So the whole idea, I think, is a little bit silly.
It is. It's also standing in the way of getting real relief to Gazan civilians, because the only way to actually get relief into Gaza is to secure Gaza from Hamas terrorists and allow the relief trucks to be protected by a third party or by Israel itself. Am I speaking the truth there? The only way to really get aid to Gaza is to end the war with Hamas. And the only way to end the war with Hamas is to go into Rafah, get Sinwar, and close off their last battalions, dismantle them. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Every time Hamas has any ability to manage, run, distribute aid, huge amounts, sometimes most of the aid disappears. It's feeding Hamas's own battalions. They have stockpiles of food and resources and gas for electricity in their tunnels while Gazans are hungry. Israel needs, this is also a criticism I have of Israel, of our government and how we're handling the war. It's taking us a long time to realize that the IDF was much more successful, much more quickly than we expected. And so our control of the ground, our control of the need for us to really take control of the whole humanitarian aid situation has come faster than the army was planning. But Gazans are ordinary. Gazans are actually suffering. We need to be able to clear them out of certain areas to fight Hamas better in those areas, especially, for example, the last city where we haven't actually gone into, which is Rafah. If we are to defeat Hamas, we need, I think, an Israeli-run massive humanitarian aid operation in Gaza. And that's something that a little bit surprised us, because the war went, frankly, better than we expected in military terms.
Now, you know, Aviv, Americans' understanding is have to view this war through the lens of our failed effort in Afghanistan, which was successful for 2 months and failed for 20 years. Or in Iraq, where we overtoppled Saddam in 2 months and then we lost, or are in the process of losing, though our troops are still there at al-Assad and other bases. They don't understand. I don't think a majority of Americans understand. Gaza is not Iraq or Afghanistan. There is no rat line back to Pakistan or, in Saddam's case, Iran. There is no way for Hamas to get resupplied. So that you can actually beat Hamas. Am I correct?
They do have smuggling tunnels from Egypt. A lot of Egyptian officials make a lot of money, corrupt money, in allowing that smuggling operation. One of the reasons that we need to take Rafah is to cut that last supply line. But by and large, that's the exception to the rule. The rule, you are correct. Hamas can be entirely cut off from its supporters, from its patrons, whether that's Qatar or Iran. And it can, the regime, right? I don't know what it means to destroy the idea. I don't need to destroy the idea. The regime in Gaza can be destroyed, absolutely.
Well, on that note, I don't know if you listen.
I should say America did that in northern Iraq to ISIS. In other words,
yes.
For every Afghanistan, there are examples of tremendous American successes.
Even yesterday on commentary, and I know you've been a guest of John and the gang over at the Commentary Pod, which I listen to every day. John made the note that if Hamas is defeated in full, it may be the turning point in Palestinian consciousness about their doomed war to destroy Israel, that the light may finally come on if Hamas is root and branch taken out of Gaza. Do you agree with John?
I do. I think that's the heart of things. I think that you can love Israel, you can hate Israel. It doesn't really matter what you think of Israel. At the end of the day, the Palestinian ideological elites, the factions, especially, but not only Hamas, tell Palestinians this story that they think gives them dignity, that they think gives Hamas a real power in the Palestinian political world. And the story is the Jews can be removed. Now, as long as there is a chance and your leaders are telling you the Jews can be removed, it becomes treason to seek any kind of accommodation, reconciliation. It literally just becomes collaboration, because you could actually win outright. If they come, as soon as they come to the conclusion that you cannot win outright, the Jews have nowhere to go, you can't remove them, then accommodation, nonviolence, all these other options that would actually work for them. You know, one of the interesting things in this war has been to watch the Israeli political left. Israeli left-wing voters, even deep left voters, are in the army fighting shoulder to shoulder with right-wing voters. They are fighting to remove Hamas from Gaza, remove Hamas from the Palestinian equation, so that they can then look forward to a kind of peace, a kind of reconciliation, when that option is gone from the table that Palestinians can continue to chase after. So absolutely, the heart of this conflict is the Palestinian conclusion that we cannot be removed, and seeking other ways to move forward other than endless terrorism, which hasn't worked for a century.
For our first segment, I want to close it here in a couple of minutes, Aviv. Can you explain the extent of consensus within Israel? Because people listen to Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, they get the wrong impression. The extent of the consensus on the need to finish the war with the dismantling of every Hamas battalion, the destruction of every tunnel, and the death or the exile of Sinwar and the upper leadership of the Hamas in Gaza. What's the extent of the consensus?
We have polls on this. Israelis are torn when you ask about hostages. But if you leave aside the question of hostages, let's pretend there aren't. In other words, they're willing to compromise on the some Israelis, a minority, but nevertheless they exist, are willing to compromise on the immediate destruction of Hamas in exchange for getting the hostages out. They are a minority of Israelis. Then you say to them, leaving hostages aside, do we destroy Hamas? 90% want to destroy Hamas. There simply aren't, you know, and that probably 7% don't know, like in any survey. So there simply aren't Israelis of any appreciable numbers, of any statistically relevant number, who don't see Hamas as something that we cannot live next to. I have to tell you, Hezbollah is the same story. In the north right now, the American envoy to Lebanon just said yesterday, we have to find a diplomatic solution. Diplomatic solution is the only solution. But I have to tell you that on the ground, 86,000 Israelis won't go home to their towns in the north. And on the Lebanese side of the border, there are 100,000 Lebanese residents of the 200 villages of South Lebanon who also haven't gone home in 5 months. If you just go by the wisdom of the crowds, of ordinary people and what they think is happening, there's a war coming, because we
there's
can't
a war
live with Hezbollah.
And I don't know that Americans know that. During our break, that will be on our podcast, and I'll be back on the radio show with Aviv in about 6 minutes, so stay tuned. But there is a war coming, and Americans don't know it because our political leadership, not Israel, is confused, worried about Dearborn, Michigan, absolutely wrong-headed to let Kamala Harris be the messenger because she screwed it up, as did President Biden. I'll talk about what Aviv thinks about American messaging when we come back for the podcast, and I'll be back on the radio in 6 minutes. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Back now with Aviv Redig-Gur of the Times of Israel. Aviv, I've been asking my guests for the 20 years since 9/11, 23 years, have they read The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright? Because it explains Saeed Qutb and the Muslim Brotherhood, and why Sadat had to take them out, and why they killed Sadat, and how Mubarak got toppled by them, and why Sisi doesn't want to let the... It explains it all. If you read under the... I can't remember the name of the book of Qutb, but he wrote two books, Milestones and Under the Shade of Some Sort of Tree. You realize they're fanatics. You're never going to deal with them. Our leadership, American leadership, doesn't seem to get this. So what do you, Aviv, as an Israeli, think about President Biden warning Bibi not to carpet bomb, which you've never done and won't do, and Kamala Harris just getting it all wrong? I mean, how do you react to the ignorance of Americans on this?
You put me in a bad spot, and I'll tell you why. President Biden and many other presidents, Republican and Democratic, have done a lot for Israel. And I am a firm believer in two things. First of all, in gratitude. Gratitude is a commandment that we are given by Judaism, and I want to be grateful. And so it's hard for me to now, I think that there are policy mistakes. I think that there are specific ideas that they've been getting wrong in this administration. I criticized a great deal the Obama administration. I had some concerns with the Trump administration, but not so much in the Middle East. And I don't want to get into domestic American politics at all. It's not my place. That's first of all. Second of all, let me tell you what Israelis think of America. When President Obama was first sworn in back in 2009, we did a poll. There was a poll of Israelis. He had 70% approval in Israel the day he was sworn in. He was a rock star. And when President Trump was sworn in, he had 70% approval in Israel. He was a rock star. Do you know what Israelis love? They don't really understand the culture war. They understand America itself. The American-led world order, this American idea of democracy and freedom and liberalism, changed the world and made the world safer for everybody everywhere. That Israelis understand, and that's what Israelis love. We speak Hebrew. You know, we don't understand. I'm paid to pay attention to America, but most Israelis do not. We don't know your culture wars and your abortion and healthcare and those are not issues that are at all on Israelis' radar. So right now, I'll answer your question, but I don't want it to be sort of, I'm trying to give the Israeli mainstream view. I don't want to say, Biden is very popular in Israel right at this moment. And by the way, so is Trump. In the same polls, so is Trump. So I think that the one thing that they are missing, and it goes back to Iran, and I have to say, I'm starting to see an awakening. I think they're missing that they really mean it. Hamas means it, and it will destroy Gaza, never mind Israel, on its vision of Islamic redemption and holy war. Hezbollah means it and is willing to see Lebanon destroyed. And Iran has already demolished four Arab countries. It will demolish more, and it will demolish until it is either defeated or wins. And if you don't understand that, none of your policies are going to matter. My problem with with President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, it wasn't one of those technical policy issues and policy questions. They had some points, some argument. My problem was that the whole thing was based on trusting Khamenei to actually fulfill his side of the deal. If he doesn't fulfill his side of the deal, you've already released all the hundreds of billions of dollars in sanctions. In other words, there's no capping it back. There's no.
They were on the ropes. Loop. We're going to come back on the radio show, Habib. They were on the ropes. Biden let them off the ropes. Now we got to put them back on the ropes because they are the source of all evil. We'll be right back with Habib Redig-Gur. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. Habib Redig-Gur is my guest. If you listen to the podcast today, you'll hear a segment where he explains the delicacy with which Israelis approach American politics. It is the same deference I pay towards Israeli politics. I don't have any idea. When the Israeli Supreme Court is being debated, I read it with interest, but I don't venture an opinion because I teach constitutional law in America. I don't know anything about constitutional law in Iran, except what Michael Oren has taught me, and he's not a lawyer. So I try and stay out of this. But I do know that we've got Benny Gantz in the country, and I know he is the most popular leader in Israel. Maybe Gallant is. Bibi is not right now. But I don't think people, it's not an American election. It's not a scrum. Are they fundamentally linked? Do you think Gantz is giving the message? And might Bibi be playing Biden to quote, I believe it was Seth Mandel, but it might have been someone else. Bibi is playing Biden to get as much aid and give Bibi as much and give Biden as much rope as he wants, because you need the weaponry. We get it to you, and we're not going to stop giving it to you. But is Gantz given the message that, hey, we're all together here, and you've got to stop telling us we're doing things wrong? We're not carpet bombing. In fact, I think you've lost 248 soldiers now, which is a remarkably low casualty rate for the kind of plan Hamas had. Do you think Gantz is delivering that message?
I think so. I hope so. I can tell you that Gantz is sort of rose in politics on what we call in Israel the center left, but he really represents a very centrist. There are a lot of Netanyahu voters in the last election who are polling right now. I mean, a couple hundred thousand probably who are polling right now as supporting Gantz. So he's a very mainstream, middle of the road political leader right now, and that very centrism is what attracts Israelis, because there's a war on and the soldiers are fighting. And there's a feeling that polarization now is a kind of betrayal of the soldiers and of the country. And so that is what Gantz's fantastic showing in the polls really is about. So I think that he's come to Washington. I don't think he's come to Washington to coordinate with the Biden administration against Netanyahu or run any kind of Israeli political, you know, gambit or anything like that. I really do think he's one of the five members of the War Council, of the sort of inner cabinet committee that's actually running the war. And I think this is coordinating the war effort. The Biden administration has gotten more and more concerned about humanitarian aid. I have gotten more and more concerned about humanitarian aid. I have a lot of sympathy and understanding for the Israeli government's, you know, successful management of the war so far, with this one big problem that we have to solve if we're going to destroy Hamas, if we're going to help shape the day after in ways that are in Israel's interest and safe for Israelis. So I do think that the Israeli government needs to be more present. I think that's what he's basically come to coordinate on. And I think it's basically good news. I don't see politicking and downsides in his visit.
Now, Aviv, what I'm always falling back on is the American experience. And Americans expected, they didn't expect to win quickly in Afghanistan or Iraq. And they did the initial battles and they lost the long war because there was no planning. But like Bush's view on WMD, which was widely shared among the Democrats, Bibi had a view on Hamas, which is the mow the grass view, which turned out to be wrong. But how widespread was acceptance of his model? Did anyone ever run against him saying you're wrong about Hamas? They're going to unleash 3,000 barbarians to go like out of the Asia steppe to murder everyone. A pogrom that we haven't seen since the late 1800s, early 1900s. Did anyone disagree with Bibi publicly about his assessment?
Not in the mainstream, but from the far right, you saw some very vociferous, very loud disagreement on that point that said that we actually have to destroy Hamas, remove Hamas, defeat Hamas. It wasn't taken as a very serious view by most of mainstream politicians and political parties, because the cost of removing Hamas from Gaza was, well, was this war. I mean, the cost was insanely high. As long as things looked stable, as long as it seemed reasonable to take the path of least resistance, why would you take on these those incredible costs? So you had these right-wing political parties that said that. You had from the far left some people who said some version of that, not we have to destroy Hamas, but we have to make peace with Hamas, which, you know, they didn't ask Hamas, right? That was something they thought just the Israelis could somehow manage to do. But no, I would say that 80% of Israeli politics, broadly speaking, either backed Netanyahu or didn't actually come up with any alternative to what Netanyahu's policy was.
But it's pass fail in Israeli politics, right? Either you get it right or you get it wrong, and Bibi got it wrong, and he will pay the price at the next election. We got a minute to our last segment, Aviv.
Yeah, it was his policy. It was a policy he fought for against those right-wingers, even when they were the linchpin in his coalition. He defended it. He allowed hundreds of millions of dollars to be given to Hamas by Qatar. He thought Hamas was a stabilizing force. He was dead wrong. We paid for those 10 years of quiet that he bought us on credit. And politically, he should pay the price.
Quickly, I don't expect elections for a long time. I don't expect this war to be over because I think it's going to go to the north. Do you agree with my assessment?
I don't expect the war to be over because it's really a long war with Iran and will go to the north and maybe even beyond that. But I do think that elections might be possible if the protests start in real force.
I'm coming back for one more segment with Aviv Redig-Gurr. Find it on the podcast today. Always find him at Times of Israel, usually on a Sunday night broadcast released by Dan Senor on Call Me Back. Probably the most calm and a younger voice for Israel than Michael Oren and I talking about Israel. So you definitely don't want to miss him whenever you see him. I'll be right back with him in hour number two of today's Super Tuesday edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. So I'm back with Aviv Redig-Gurr for my final segment. Aviv, Egypt will not open their border crossing. They're building this giant concrete pen, and I've seen the pictures of it. It seems to me they might have a plan to help you with Rafah by allowing in women and children and boys under the age of 12. Why won't Sisi let them into Egypt? I know the answer, but it better come from you than me.
Yeah, there are two reasons. The first reason is they don't want them. Half of Gaza's population is under the age of 18. Hamas has ruled Gaza for 17 years. Hamas has taught Hamas teachers, schools have taught half the population of Gaza, and of course, much more than that as adults. And Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the mortal enemy of the current regime in Egypt. And so they see the Gazans as literal enemies. Also, they don't want to appear to the Arab world to be helping with what some in the Arab world suspect is an Israeli attempt to push the Palestinians out of Gaza. So right-wing Israelis can build settlements there. That is not what's going on. It's not remotely what's going on. Polls tell us that well above 80% of Israelis don't want that to happen. It's not going to happen. But the image of it is something that the Sisi regime sees as very dangerous for its standing in the Arab world. So it has absolutely sealed that border, both for its own survival and also for the PR of not appearing to help the Israelis clear the Palestinians out of Gaza.
All right, last question, Aviv. The military operation has gone very well. And that's not only your opinion, it's the opinion of people like Daniil Hartman, who I don't really understand what his politics are, or Yossi Klein. It's gone very, very well. Does America know how well it's gone and how careful the IDF has been to proceed cautiously and with proportionate force against a very difficult to find target? Do you think that's been adequately explained, or is that a failure of the IDF to communicate?
Well, first of all, yeah, I think the IDF's not very good at communicating. Luckily, it's good at other things. But I would say that we are also living in the shadow of a really profound change that came over the IDF over the last 5 months. The army that went into Gaza City, the northernmost of Gaza's cities, was an army that hadn't really fought a serious ground war in two generations. And it's an army that solved most of the problems that it ever faced with the Air Force. And now it saw these astonishing tunnel networks and Hamas hiding in those tunnel networks. And it decided to try to solve the problem. You know, it had a hammer, so it decided that everything is a nail. And so you saw airstrikes at a scale that really, really caused civilian harm that was televised on TikTok in ways that I don't think it was more in how these things are measured than what happened in Mosul, but it was certainly televised more than what happened in Mosul. By the time the army 2 months later gets into Khan Yunis, it's a ground operation, it's a ground army that has learned how to fight on the ground. There's only so much training you can give an army. Experience is by far the most important kind of training. And by the time the army is coming to central Gaza and Khan Yunis, it knows how to pull those Hamas guys out of the tunnels. It knows how to kill them. It knows how to destroy the tunnels with much, much less civilian harm, with much less airstrikes. And so you saw a huge reduction in the rate of Palestinian deaths, and that's only gone. The army itself has become more expert. Hamas has started dying at a higher rate. At one point, Hamas even had to admit it had any losses, right? It claimed 6,000 dead by the time Israel was saying it had 13,000 dead fighters. Hamas had to claim some dead fighters because everyone was just laughing at the fact that, according to Hamas's death toll rates out of Gaza, there were zero Hamas fighters dead for 4 months. But the point is that the army has gotten better, more targeted, more able to protect civilians while pulling Hamas out of those tunnels. Hamas's only strategy is mass civilian deaths. Yihya Sinwar, Hamas's leader, is sitting in a tunnel under Rafah, or probably under Rafah, possibly in Khan Yunis, and he is thinking to himself one big thought. He needs five times as many Palestinian civilian dead. That's what might, he hopes, stop the Israeli war machine. He has no other strategy. Hamas has no other strategy other than Palestinian civilian dead. And so our learning how to fight them from under the civilians with a much reduced rate of civilian deaths on the Palestinian side has been a game changer for our ability to actually destroy Hamas. So the answer is, first of all, yes. Second of all, increasingly so. And third of all, Hamas isn't a real problem because we know how to kill them without killing a lot of Palestinians now.
Last question then. When do you expect the operation against Rafah to commence? When does Haviv? I know you're not tied in with the IDF. You're not a spokesman for the government. But what does Israel want? Do they want it sooner, or are they willing to wait for all of Ramadan to pass before they begin? Because that's a nightmare from a PR point of view, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's everything I just said about being able to get at Hamas from under the civilian population in Rafah would be much, much harder because there's such a densely packed civilian population of people who fled from the north and from the center of Gaza. So we have to figure out how to move civilians around when there's very little places to actually move them in order to get to Hamas. It has to happen. I think that the planning is well underway in the army. I think that it's possible it'll start during Ramadan, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like that. But I think that there is this desire, and Gantz is in Washington in part to talk about it, there's this desire to really have a solid plan in place for moving the civilians before that final operation starts. You have to assume this is Hamas's last stand. We're going to be in a counterinsurgency for 2-3 years, but this is Hamas's last stand as serious, fully fledged, you know, standing battalions. You have to assume they're going to put up a fight, unlike what we've seen so far, which is them trying but failing to actually put up a serious fight in most places. So I would guess a month, but again, it's a decision of about 5 people. It's very hard to predict what 5 people are going to do. But it makes sense to me on the timeline of the war, about a month.
Okay, we have 30 seconds. Your prediction for the next leader of Iran, of Israel. I know who leads Iran, and God knows who the next nut is going to be as the supreme leader. But how about Israel? Is it going to be Gantz, or is it going to be Gallant?
I think it's going to be Gantz first. I don't think Likud, even if Netanyahu falls miserably, Likud is going to be out of power for very long. Likud has strong fundamentals and a loyal base of supporters. And whoever replaces Netanyahu, which right now Gallant looks set to replace him, Likud politics are complicated, it might not be him, but Likud will be back in government within a couple of years, maybe 4 or 5 years, depends on how many election cycles we get.
Always good to talk to you, Aviv. Thank you. You're doing great service to Israel by your working overtime with all these American outlets, and I appreciate your time. Good luck to you. Stay safe. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is back with us. We're very happy about that. Welcome back, Mr. Secretary. I hope your 2024 is off to a great year.
It has been. Pray that yours has, and all your listeners as well. It's good to be with you, Hugh.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. There's a story out this morning. Administration officials watered down Kamala Harris' Gaza speech before delivery. The original draft was harsher on Israel about the dire humanitarian situation and the need for more aid. As you look at so-called American diplomacy vis-a-vis Israel's war of survival, what are your thoughts about its coherence and its purpose?
Well, it's been a mess with respect to the Middle East for the last 3 years. They have fundamentally misunderstood the problem set, Hugh. The problem set isn't that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is led by a pariah. It's not that Israel is conducting a war of aggression. It is that the Iranian regime is attempting to undermine all of the prosperity and all the peace that we had built out during the 4 years of the Trump administration. And so you see the result. Missiles being fired at our young servicemen in the Red Sea, service members killed in the Middle East by strikes from the Iranians. And now Americans continue to be held hostage in Gaza. It has upended the basic order that we had begun to build out, and dangerous for Israel, dangerous for the Gulf Arab states, and dangerous for us as well, Hugh.
What I would love to hear is the American leadership make an articulate and expansive report on why we support Israel and why they have to win to get relief to Gaza. Do you agree with that perspective that we really need? I mean, Joe Biden, not capable of a really good speech, but he could try at least to deliver the basic message that Hamas is evil, Israel is good, and the only way to save Gaza is to get Israel in command of the entire strip. Agree or disagree, Mr. Secretary?
That is the right conclusion and the right argument as well. I can't imagine President Biden or Vice President Harris making that kind of definitive remarks about the pathway towards what is in America's best interest and Israel's best interest. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they do it. In the end, the crushing of Hamas is necessary for peace and prosperity in the region.
Now, you're an astute observer of politics. You were, of course, first in your class at West Point. You're a Harvard Law School trained lawyer. You see what's going on with lawfare. Are you worried that lawfare is undermining our ability to tell our allies to conduct elections fairly and not to imprison their opponents?
Deeply worried. We all saw the decision from yesterday, 9-0, when Justice Sotomayor comes out in a way that is consistent with my legal analysis. You know that politics has trumped a basic understanding of the Constitution. So I am worried about it. The scale of these attacks, the absurdity of some of these attacks suggest to folks around the world watching that this looks like a country that they don't know. The deep 250 years of rule of law in the United States is at jeopardy because of these domestic political efforts to undermine our democratic system. And I do worry about our elections. We're gonna all go. We got big day today, Super Tuesday, all around the country. We got big elections just a few months off. absentee ballots and the process by and the manner in which they're handled is something that we have to make sure we get right. So every voter knows that their guy, their gal won, or their guy or their gal didn't. And that has not been the case in these handful of last elections.
Now, Mr. Secretary, I believe the former president is also going to be the next president. And I try and be objective about this, but I do believe our president's infirmity is impossible to hide, and his vice president's extremism is impossible to hide. You agree with my assessment about that?
I do. I take no joy in it. I want President Biden to be successful, but we can all see, we can all observe that this is not working for the American people. You know, the simple example that we all see every day is the invasion across our southern border. A basic rule of law needs to be upheld. To the previous question, Hugh, when I travel around the world, people see what's going on at our southern border. They ask, what is going on? That no country would allow millions of people to come into their nation unlawfully, unregulated, unvetted every single month, month on month. This is dangerous, and the world is watching to see if America is prepared to do the basic blocking and tackling required to make sure that America will be successful.
Yeah, in the 62 years...
They want us to lead.
They do want us to lead. In the 62 years that Ellis Island was open, 12 million immigrants came through in 62 years. And I think that is noble. They were vetted. They were held in quarantine if necessary. None of that is happening. But I'm going to drill down from the 10 million illegals probably come across the border since Biden to the 45,000 Chinese nationals that have been encountered. That's the term of choice at the DHS right now at the border, which is so far above what happened under your team's administration of the border and President Trump's. It's startling. It's stunning. It's a bit scary. What do you think is going on there, Mr. Secretary?
So, Hugh, the number is absolutely staggering. We were less than 1,000 during our time of Chinese nationals coming across the border. They're now ticking along at hundreds a month. It's also the composition of those coming across. These are mostly non-family, single males, 18 to 30. You know this. We've talked about China so many times. The Chinese Communist Party has a deep plan. The chance that these folks are randomly appearing at our southern border, that these folks are all economic migrants or asylum seekers, is precisely zero. The Chinese Communist Party knows deeply what is taking place. And if you add that to the money laundering that the Chinese Communist Party is doing with the cartels, the movement of fentanyl, you now have a Chinese Communist Party effort on our southern border that is intentional and at scale and could, if permitted to continue, put enormous risk on the United States of America.
We do not get the breakdown on Russians and Iranians coming across the border, but I view the Iron Triangle of China as the senior partner with Russia and Iran as their junior partners as pretty much soldered together. Is that a correct view of the world, Mr. Secretary?
It is, and I would add, if they'll permit two junior partners into the firm, the Venezuelans and the North Koreans, I think you would have the entire partnership identified. And you can see it with what's going on in Venezuela with Russians and Chinese officials. You can see that in Cuba, too. You can see it with North Korea providing munitions to the to the Russians so that they can kill kids in Ukraine. This is a concerted effort by those who despise the very nature of our republic. And if we treat them singly, if we treat them as one-offs, if we don't see what's happening in the Middle East, in Israel, as connected to what's happening in Europe today in Ukraine, then we will make a fundamental mistake in understanding the global threat that is presented.
Mr. Secretary, you're on a lot of lists for being SecDef or vice president or back at Secretary of State. Would you ever not tell the president you were going in for surgery for 3 days? That was Lloyd Austin. You've been the Secretary of State, but it's the same, the big three, AG, State, and Defense. Can you imagine that happening under Trump 1?
No, I can't imagine. First of all, we were all communicating with the president, not every day, but most days. Can't imagine that long a gap in communication between the President of the United States and Secretary of Defense, and nor can I imagine making the intentional decision to say, I'm going to hide this from my boss. You talk about being on a lot of lists. I'm on a list at home to take the trash out and all kinds of things, Hugh. But communication sharing where the person who's in touch and in charge of the nuclear codes, not sharing that with their partner in holding on to those codes is absurd and dangerous.
All right, I want to get to Ukraine, but after I ask one more political question, do you think that they have a coherent policy on anything in the Biden administration? I mean, I look at Ukraine, it's always too little, too late for too long. when I look at China, they don't talk the way you talked about the CCP. And when I look at Iran, they gave them billions and billions of dollars, which ended up in Hamas tunnels and Hezbollah rockets. Is there a coherent mastermind behind Biden foreign policy? I don't think it's Joe.
I haven't seen their theory, right? Their global theory for the security of America. I haven't been able to identify it. If you ask her what the common theme in each of those is, it has been to appease and underutilize the power of America to deliver good outcomes for the American people. So whether it's the failure to give long-range munitions to the Ukrainians or provide them even short and medium-range munitions at the scale that they need, now that they're telling the Israelis, you're the problem, not the solution, and the way that they have permitted the Chinese Communist Party not just to fly spy balloons over our country, but to conduct espionage here, to travel across our border, to move fentanyl, to threaten the island of Taiwan. The common theme there, Hugh, I don't know that there's a strategy attached to it, but the common theme is don't upset the apple cart, fear escalation more than victory, and that's a recipe for escalation and disaster.
So I look at DOD. They can't buy anything on time. They've switched over to the frigate, which is good. I hope it's better than the LCS, but they have a recruitment crisis. Why do you think that is? You're a veteran of West Point. You served. You know the deal. Why aren't kids signing up or re-enlisting?
You have a family that has served as well. If you had a young child or frankly, if you're a young kid who's 18 years old thinking about going to the Marine recruiter station, do you want to go serve in a military that is focused on making sure that you can have transgender operations out of state, that has everybody thinking about things not related to combat, right? So much focus on climate change in the Department of Defense, so much focus on diversity and equity and inclusion. I mean, sign me up for diversity in our military. My first tank gunner was someone who was a naturalized American citizen. But when the warfighters lose the focus on warfighting, you can precisely see why young people say, nah, if I'm going to do that kind of thing, I'll go do it someplace else. I don't want to go be a sailor or a soldier or serve in our space command. I'll go do something else. If we return the military to its core function of crushing our adversaries and deterring conflict, the kids will come flocking back. They are still patriotic. They will still want to serve you.
Okay, that can be fixed. Can we fix procurement? I really don't know. We're running out of weaponry that we need to give to Ukraine and Taiwan and our friends in Israel. We are not building ships at anywhere near the pace that the CCP is. Is it possible even to fix procurement, Mr. Secretary?
It's absolutely possible. We know how to do it. There are pieces of it that are actually functioning where the private sector is helping build out in Ukraine. Private sector is helping the Israelis deliver EWS systems. Lots of good work happening. But the Department of Defense is fundamentally going to have to shift the way it thinks about bringing on new technology, how quickly it can innovate. And then you need the authority, the Department of Defense needs the authority to do that, to appropriate funds against problems, against solutions that will deliver problems not 20 years from now, 100% over budget and 2 years too late, but in real time. It's possible to do, Hugh.
Now, last question. I don't know which board you serve on or whom you advise, but I think artificial intelligence and supercomputing, we can keep our edge if we invest in it. Do you see us investing in it?
Give us a B. The private sector is doing great work. It is still the case that the best, most innovative companies are American companies with engineers working here in the United States across that spectrum. AI, quantum mechanics, cryptography, all the things around securing networks. We're still world-class. Our government is slow and hasn't provided the capital needed to get some of these small companies across the chasm so they can grow. And the Chinese Communist Party is deeply focused on it. I do worry about this year. This is a place we've got to put money and focus.
Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State, almost certainly going to be back in term two of Donald Trump should he win in November. I'll be back talking about Super Tuesday. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Always good to talk to you.
Have a good morning.
Well, stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. Joined now by the Sam Elliott of the United States Senate, Senator Tom Cotton, with whom I have not spoken on air since Mitch McConnell made his announcement that he would be retiring after the elections. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back. Number one question, were you surprised by the leader's announcement, and have you picked anyone among Dr. John Thunen, who are all three running to replace Mitch?
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be back on with you. I can't say that I was surprised that Senator McConnell decided not to seek a final term as leader before he retired from the Senate in 2026. I didn't know the exact timing of it, but I thought that might have been trending that direction after he set the record last year for what has been a remarkable run and saving the Supreme Court from Merrick Garland and Barack Obama and helping build a center-right constitutionalist majority or protecting the rights of every American to engage in free speech, especially free speech in the political arena. It truly has been a remarkable run. I believe that as of today, we have at least two people declared that they're running for the Republican leader position, John Cornyn and John Thune. I suspect we'll have at least one, maybe more, jump in as well. These are all good Republicans, and I look forward to them making their case to us and the incoming Republican senators. I think the main thing should be a focus on President Trump's reelection and the election of all of our great candidates and the handful of incumbents we have up.
Now, the electorate for leader is between 49 and 54 votes, depending on how well Republicans do in the Senate races this year. I've seen you mentioned as a dark horse. Are you running for leader?
The darkest of horses, Hugh. I want to serve in whatever role can best help my Republican senator colleagues and President Trump achieve our shared goals. Right now, I've had several colleagues encourage me to run for conference chair, which is the number three position dedicated to ensuring that we are advocating for conservative ideas and promoting the conservative message across the country. That's currently going to be open because John Barrasso is term limited from it. So that's where my focus is. I'm grateful by the support I've received from my colleagues. But as I said, the most important elections right now for the next 8 months will be that election for the White House and the election for all of our Republican senators and candidates, because we want to make sure that we are electing a Republican majority leader, not minority leader, come November, who can help a new Republican president turn the country around.
Well, that's a bit of news. Tom Cotton running for Senate conference leader. Now, what does the Senate conference leader do? Do you run the annual retreat?
So, yes, and it will be determined whether or not you're invited on how you treat me over the next year.
I was wondering about that. Now we're going to start having to move around and be deferential.
So John Barrasso has held the job for 6 years, six-year term limit. Senator Barrasso has done an outstanding job. He's helped modernize the facilities and the infrastructure so our Republican senators can reach their voters, not just, say, through traditional television and local broadcast news, so we have great studios and facilities for that, but through podcasting or other digital outreach, helping ensure that Republican senators are communicating effectively with their voters where they are, and then also going out to carry the Republican Senate's message to the American people. Again, John Barrasso has done a great job on that, but he's term limited out of it, so it's been open, we've known it's going to be open even before Senator McConnell announced he would not be seeking the leader position. And some of my colleagues first started approaching me months ago, and I'm grateful about that. I'm pleased with the level of support we've gotten. For the time being, though, I think everyone needs to focus primarily on all these Senate elections and the race for the White House to ensure that we're electing a majority leader, not a minority leader.
One more question on Senate politics before we turn to Super Tuesday. There is a generational divide, not so much ideological, but generational, between people like you and Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and J.D. Vance, who are under 50, and those of our wonderful Republican caucus who are over 50. If you were the chairman of the caucus, how would you work to kind of, it's a different language, it's a different technology, it's a different approach, it's a different ideology. How do you bridge that?
Sure. We do have certain generational divides in our conference, just like we have certain ideological divides. As conference chair, one priority is to make sure each senator has the tools and the resources they need to communicate with their voters in their states, because one thing is true is that most senators are pretty good representatives of their states. I like to think that I'm a good voice and advocate for the people of Arkansas. I might not be so well fitted for, say, the people of Maryland, as I hope Larry Hogan will be elected and be a great Republican senator for the state of Maryland. So it's helping bridge the divides, find those issues and approaches that unite us in Washington, while also helping every senator make sure that they are reaching their voters where they are in their home states.
Now, we know about Pennsylvania. Dave McCormick's been on a lot. There are three great candidates running in Ohio. I'm staying out of that until they elect their nominee. We can win with Sam Cooke in Nevada. We can win with Kerry Lake in Arizona. There are other pickups out there in Montana with Tim Sheehy and perhaps a few places I haven't mentioned. Are you going to be living on the road, Senator?
Yeah, I'm going to be out campaigning a lot in the summer and the fall this year. You know, I think in West Virginia, we're all hopeful that that race is basically off.
That's
the table.
A done deal.
Manchin's retired. If Jim Justice in that, assuming we elect, you know, the eight incumbents we have up for re-election, people like Ted Cruz, Rick Scott, Deb Fischer, Roger Wicker, that puts us at 50 going into the more competitive races. As you mentioned, there's two states where Donald Trump won twice. Tim Sheehy will be our nominee in Montana, and we'll have a nominee in Ohio in a couple more weeks. I'm confident those are two great pickup opportunities. And then there's a whole bunch of states that Donald Trump either won closely or narrowly lost in 2016 and 2020, where, again, we have great candidates that I think are good fits for their state, like Sam Brown in Nevada, Kerry Lake in Arizona, Eric Hovde in Wisconsin, Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania. We even have some blue states where Donald Trump did perform quite so well, but we have a very popular leader, former Governor Larry Hogan in Maryland as well. So I think there's going to be ample opportunity to be on the campaign trail with strong candidates delivering a compelling message this fall. And hopefully, like you said, that it's not going to be a vote of 49 or 50 Republican senators in November. That'll be a vote of 54 or 55 or 56.
You know, I think I just called Sam Brown Sam Cooke, and I'm sure he plays the guitar well, but it's nevertheless Sam Brown. And I also want to point out Larry Hogan represents the Big Tent Party, which still exists. He's a favorite of mine, except for his Ravens fandom, which we'll have to forgive to get behind him. But that's a lot of work cut out for you. Let's talk about tonight. I expect a sweep. What do you hope to see Ambassador Haley do if, in fact, it's a sweep tonight?
Well, I think the time has come, especially if Donald Trump sweeps the states today on Super Tuesday, for Ambassador Haley to announce that she is suspending her campaign supporting Donald Trump. He won't quite get to the formal number of delegates he needs to have the nomination in hand today, but it's a foregone conclusion. Obviously, this race has been trending in this direction since President Trump won landslide victories in Iowa and then in New Hampshire. I regret a little bit that we haven't been able to already unify and consolidate the party, that President Trump and the RNC haven't been able to start working together hand in glove the way Joe Biden and the DNC has done for 3 years. I wish we hadn't missed out on these last two or three weeks, but we really need to start tomorrow as one unified party, taking advantage of the momentum that President Trump and our Republican Senate and House candidates have, speaking with a single voice about the direction that we want to take this country to secure our border, to stop this migrant invasion, to get inflation under control, to help people with the quality of life that they've struggled so much under Joe Biden, restore respect in America.
Well, I have a bit of advice, Senator. I want you to encourage your Republican colleagues to applaud long and hard whenever it's possible, because the president doesn't want that State of the Union to go long. I don't think he's got the energy to make it a 30-minute speech, but he's going to try and peddle a lie about the border negotiation being the fault of Republicans. That's not true. Jim Lankford did the best job he could, but the wall wasn't there. And I think Gallup has showed us that the immigration disaster has become the number one issue in the United States, even ahead of the economy, which bothers a lot of Americans. Do you think that's going to change between now and November?
No, I don't think it'll change, Hugh, because Joe Biden doesn't want the situation order to change. He promised in the campaign that he would invite the entire world to come illegally to our country, and that's exactly what he did on day one of his presidency. He and his party are ideologically invested in open borders. Now, you're right that whether you supported that bill or opposed that bill, Joe Biden has it in his authority to stop or substantially slow the flow of illegal migrants. He just refuses to do so. So what you're going to see on Thursday night is a lot of blame shifting, a lot of avoidance of responsibility. I suspect you'll see President Biden make it through the speech just fine. And when he steps over that very low bar, the media is going to declare that Joe Biden is back and he's got his mojo back and so on and so forth. Just remember, Hugh, if Joe Biden were 20 years younger and very sprightly, he would still be a failed president. His old age and his failing condition is just a small part of the problem. The bigger part of the problem is that he's a liberal ideologue. That's why we have an open border, why we have runaway inflation, and why America is a laughingstock around the world.
You know, I spent 30 minutes talking to Aviv Redinger, who's become sort of the Charles Krauthammer of Israel. I like talking to Michael Oren and him about the fact that Kamala Harris' speech had to be toned down. It was still anti-Israel. Joe Biden has been a sort of schizophrenic on Israel. And I don't believe what the message that we're sending. The Gaza humanitarian crisis is the result of Hamas refusing to surrender. They want that crisis. Do you think Biden and Harris believe that?
I don't know if they believe it or not, Hugh. I do know that all of the energy and enthusiasm in the Democratic Party is opposed to Israel and, in many cases, outright anti-Semitic. And you see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris demagoguing to that far left anti-Israel, anti-Semitic wing of their party. And you see them excusing, you know, just a few months on from the worst massacre of Jews since World War II, what Hamas is doing. Not just what it did to Jews in Israel, but what it continues to do to the hostages that it's holding, not just Israeli hostages, but American hostages as well, and to civilians in Gaza. And the Biden administration is bending over backwards to try to act, in effect, as the lawyer for Hamas at negotiations with Israel, instead of backing Israel to the hilt so it can achieve its objective, which is a righteous objective, of totally and utterly destroying Hamas's war-making capability and governing authority.
Last question. You mentioned the law. You're a lawyer, allegedly. You went to Harvard Law School. I'm not sure they actually taught con law there. But this 9-0 decision yesterday was easy to see, but it still caused the left to melt down. Presidential immunity from criminal prosecution, much more difficult case. I don't have a prediction on that. But could you believe the way the media reacted to what was, in essence, a done deal yesterday?
Well, Hugh, yesterday's decision reminds me of the old joke. Why did all these liberal states trying to exclude Donald Trump from the ballot lose 9-0? It's because there aren't 11 justices of the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Senator Cotton, thank you for joining me. I appreciate breaking a little news here. Campaigning for Republican conference chairman. That's interesting. And we will get reaction to that going forward. Thank you, Senator.
Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is a... And it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's...
844-644-1900.
Also want to remind you, Alliance Defending Freedom. At the very top of HughHewitt.com. Supreme Court came through for the country yesterday, 9-0. It wasn't the 6-3 court with the conservatives, originalists on one side and the lefties on the left. It was 9-0, restoring Donald Trump to the ballot. And I knew it was going to be 9-0 because the chaos that comes from allowing states to decide which candidates are going to let run for president, which candidates are not going to let run for president. In the absence of an insurrection conviction, which is, in fact, a federal crime with which Donald Trump was not charged by Jack Smith, he's not guilty of insurrection. There's no way he gets tossed off a ballot. The Maine Secretary of State embarrassed, reversed herself yesterday. Colorado Secretary of State cried crocodile tears. They lose at the Supreme Court when they come up against either just the obvious nature of the case or the Alliance Defending Freedom. I like to win on religious liberty, education choice, making sure that boys play boys and girls play girls in high school. And that's what Alliance Defending Freedom does. They protect the free speech rights of everyone out there. They protect your First Amendment rights to free exercise of religion. They're against the establishment of religion, but they understand what it means, which most of the left doesn't. And they are just generally the best legal defense firm in America. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the ReliefFactor.com studio out west. I'm holding down part of the fort on the Salem News Channel coverage tonight, but I haven't got anything like the workload of our next guest, Brett Baer, host of Special Report, chief political reporter and correspondent for Fox News. How late are you going to be up tonight, Brett?
Well, I don't know. We have got a 7 to 11 show, but we'll be hanging around and calling the California race. I think a lot of these races, obviously, we can call right at the beginning. Once we get some raw vote total in, based on everything we have coming in, I think most of these polls heading into today had the former president rolling, and he's looking to clinch mathematically by March 19th.
Now the president, the former president, is no dummy. He showed up on one radio show yesterday, Howie Carr, who dominates the Northeast. The only place he's vulnerable is Massachusetts and Vermont. So he shows up on Howie, who owns the Northeastern airwaves, and he says this, Brett, cut number 5.
Well, I do, and I was very honored by a 9-0 vote. And this is for future presidents. This is not for me. This is for future presidents, all presidents. And the next thing coming up, I think, which will be of equal importance, will be immunity, because the president...
You know, I don't think the Colorado Supreme Court intended to give President Trump a gift, but they did.
Well, that's true. It is true. And, you know, there'll be all kinds of reading between the lines of the opinions and the concurrent opinion and what that really meant. But the bottom line is 9-0. And the message was, Illinois, Maine, you're in the wrong time zone. You know, you got to get back on track here, because it's not not going to fly with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you know, the only time I've ever got really excited on a special report panel is when Jessica Tarlov was telling me there was merit to the Colorado Supreme Court case.
And right.
It was the easiest case ever. Now, the immunity case is not. I really have no predictions on the immunity case, because there's got to be some limits on local prosecutors going after the president of the United States. But Jack Smith's a special counsel, and I don't have any opinion on that, but it's not going to play into tonight, right?
I don't think so. I mean, we'll definitely have some legal analysis of what the former president is up against. I mean, he's cleared a number of hurdles, but he still has everything in Manhattan. He's got, you know, the financial burden of trying to put up that money in order to appeal the other cases. And, you know, it's not insignificant what he's facing. It's just a race against the clock.
My words, not yours. I do think it's election interference. It's not coordinated, but it's all happening at once when he's got a 5-point lead in the New York Times poll. Now, the Fox News poll did not give him that significant of a lead, but you and I pay attention to the Times-Siena poll. I was kind of stunned to see 5%, Brett. Were you?
I was, and I was also stunned inside those numbers, other questions about ability to serve and too old to serve. The fact that the current president, 73% saying he is too old to serve, and it's like 44 for the former president. I think that the numbers in the Siena poll were really, really horrible for President Biden. And, you know, we've said all along that these polls have to have alarm bells. Well, the alarm bells have been going off for a while. It's just that I don't see the logistics of how it all moves if he's not going to be the nominee.
I don't see it moving at all. Brett, I got to ask you a funny question about golf, because I think it proves the infirmity question. I played this weekend. I didn't play. I rode along because I didn't want to ruin John Ratcliffe's game. He's a 2-handicapper, and the guy shot a 75 with 8 birdie putts, of which he made one, so he's mad at himself. You've probably been there and done that. When someone plays golf the way Donald Trump plays golf, can it possibly be fair to call him infirm like Joe Biden?
No. I'm telling you that he is a very, very, very good golfer. That's three berries. And he, you know, often shoots under his age regularly. And, you know, golf is not, as you know, an easy sport.
It's a horrible game. I hate it, but it takes a lot of
time. between the ears, you know, it's a lot between the ears. And I think that that's a good test. How somebody speaks, obviously, and how they communicate is a different test, but that's one test, and he's passed that.
Okay, the failure to warn, which I use against Sonny Bunch, my movie critic. I'm going to warn you, do not play Ratcliffe for money unless you're getting the strokes, Brett. And I know you're pretty doggone good, too. So the decision desk format has changed over the years. And Salem doesn't run a decision desk. That requires a lot of people. How does Fox do it now?
Yeah, this is going to be, you know, a large challenge, because it's a lot of states all at once. Some of the smaller states, we will let the Associated Press make the call, but the bigger states where we have surveys on the ground, this is a rolling survey. It's called Fox News Voter Analysis, and basically it's a poll of a lot of people in a certain state that starts 3 days before and goes until after they vote. I mean, essentially, it's an exit poll plus. And we've seen a lot of accuracy with those numbers, really, going back to election cycles.
All right, last question, Brett, and you don't hold back, so don't if you disagree with me. I have a new Fox News opinion column this morning. I write on Tuesdays and Thursdays mornings, and the titles I get to pick. It's simply, it's the border stupid. And I believe this issue more than any other issue. The president's infirmity is an issue, but the border issue is an alarm. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do agree with that. I think it is seeped into being the number one issue, as we've seen in every poll, every state that we've had voting in. It's the number one issue, and it's blue states, red states, it's across the board. I do think that how the president is trying to deal with it about, you know, the Senate bill is getting lost in the mix, you know, the process of a bipartisan effort, really, which wasn't bipartisan because it didn't get voted on in the House, I think is lost. And the main issue are these visuals and what these cities are dealing with. So I agree with you. I think immigration is the bottom line of this election. Could change, but right now that's it. And I do think that the age factor plays in for President Biden.
Now, I'm going to watch one race in particular tonight. I've got friends running in Orange County for the Board of Education, where charter schools are a big issue, and I'll watch that, Ken Williams and his buddies. But I'm going to be watching Steve Garvey and whether or not he can knock Katie Porter out of that second place. Because if he does, Adam Schiff's pretty much going to be Senator Schiff unless miracles happen. But the immigration issue is the one that's going to power Steve Garvey, because even in California, there are more Republican voters in California than in any other state in the union. They don't win anything because there aren't enough, but they can vote, mobilize based on these ads and these visuals. And they watch you, Brett, and they watch Fox generally, and they listen to me. I don't think Democrats have quite figured out how much peril they're in. Last question. Do you think they know?
I think some know. And they're putting up the red flares inside the party, but some do not and believe that it's just going to be business as usual. I had Steve Garvey on the show last night.
Oh, you did?
And he's impressive, and I think that his message is, you know, catered towards California, you know, a California Republican who could win. I think that, you know, once you get past this, if he's top two, I agree, it's an uphill battle. But it's not crazy to believe that California, with all its issues, may be fed up and send a protest vote.
Yeah, I've only had one conversation with Adam Schiff. He's not the world's most dynamic person in person, and he's got a embedded image in the minds of Republicans and some Democrats. And he's going to have a lot of angry Democrats who are Katie Porter people and Barbara Lee Pate people. So Garvey is kind of the perfect palimpsest to write upon. I'll have to go back and find that interview and play it. Glad to hear you think he's impressive. Brett Baer, get some sleep. You're going to be up late tonight, unlike me. Well done, and thank you for joining me.
All right, we'll see you.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.